For KOSU, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time for This Week in Oklahoma Politics, along with Republican political consultant Neva Hill and ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel. Well, the state House passes a bill to cut state agencies and raid state funds to pay for the $215 million shortfall and end the special session as soon as possible. The state Senate is expecting to vote on the bill today. Neva, your thoughts on this budget fix?
Well, I mean, it was the it's your fault, back and forth. And they wound up 5 votes above what they needed on the 51 necessary to get it passed in the House. As we see right now, the Senate will take this up. I think there's some expectation that it may get through, although I think they'll have the back and forth, name-calling, name-pointing, finger-pointing, and so on and so forth to finally get it to a vote. And really, the bottom line is, after all of this, I mean, we're back where we started, and that's the unfortunate part. And I think that's where we've got such a fault line now for the legislature as they attempt to get out of this special session, and look what's coming down the road in the general session starting in February. So I think that it's regrettable that that we have the level of consternation and hostility that's developed, because nothing good is going to come out of that. And I think we've got a situation where, as they get away from the building, as they get away from the Capitol, and they have some opportunity to kind of reflect, get back with their constituents, develop their own ideas on what to do when they come back into session, maybe we can start off on better footing than we did during this 8-week or whatever it was special session.
Ryan.
Well, you know, I think the consternation and hostility that Neva referred to, I think that there are a couple of different sources for that. I think the first source, if you're a Republican in the House, the consternation and the hostility comes from the fact that you are suffering under failed legislative leadership. You know, they've been in special session now for 8 weeks, and this is, you know, David Blatt, in his a blog post on the Oklahoma Policy Institute's website, calls this a squandered opportunity, and that's what it is it's a squandered opportunity to do something. And I think that if you're a Democrat or a Republican, a lot of that consternation and hostility comes down to the fact that the budget crisis that we are in right now is costing Oklahomans their lives, their livelihoods, their safety, their health. This is a dire time for the state of Oklahoma, and this is not the budget that Oklahomans deserve. We're going to walk into this next legislative session with a $650 million deficit as things stand. This is pulled together with scotch tape and spit, and it's not going to get us to where we need to be. The governor had said early on in the special session that if a budget like this hit her desk, that she would veto it. I think that after watching the legislative session for 8 weeks, and the inability, in particular, of Speaker Charles McCall to deliver 75% of his caucus, or even 70% of his caucus, on a revenue bill, I think that demonstrates that, to her, that the current legislative leadership is incapable of giving her a responsible budget. And not only are they incapable of doing it, but now we're seeing the head budget negotiator in the House, Representative Leslie Osborne, even admitting at some point this legislative week that some of the failed revenue votes were actually orchestrated to set people up for bad votes, and they weren't part of a sincere package to fund government.
Well,
in Oklahoma.
And here's what's going to be interesting where the governor's concerned. I mean, she made it clear in her statement after the vote in the House how disappointed she was. All along, she said that she would veto what she called draconian cuts. Now we'll see whether these cuts, you know, kind of get to the edge, but are something that she, in fact, would sign if they make it through the Senate. The bigger issue, I think, for the governor, looking back on what's happened to this point, is that they were 5 votes short on the bill that she wanted to see passed. And, you know, by all appearances and every evidence there, she was unable, by her own efforts, to try to sway or convince 5 additional folks to come across the line and vote for that particular bill. So I think it puts the governor in a very difficult spot coming into her final session, her final state of the state, after a long career in government, trying to double down and then not being able to get a handful of votes. I mean, is a very difficult place to be. And I think when the other other thing that's fascinating to me this week is the advantage waiver. I mean, the House and the Senate unanimously moved on that action and passed it. It's on the governor's desk, and as of the time we're recording right now, she has not signed it. And so I think to suggest that there's some sort of political leverage to leave it on your desk and think that that might be something to use while you're waiting to see what the final outcome in the Senate's going to be seems preposterous, too, when we have people flooding the Capitol trying to make their statement, the public overwhelmingly telling their representatives, their senators, we want this passed, and they, in fact, did do that.
The Advantage Waiver Program, 20,000-plus Oklahomans, frail, elderly, disabled, that rely on that program for their very lives. And so that's, and I think that that's the situation that the governor's in. I think that that's the situation that the legislature's in right now, is that they had this opportunity to come in and begin, even if they didn't solve all of our budget woes, but to begin to put us on the path so that in this next legislative session that we'd have something to build upon. That's not happened. And now the governor, I really think, is forced to sign this, because if she doesn't, if she doesn't sign this and say, I go back to the drawing board, those cuts take place on December 1.
Well, but, and let's be clear about the cuts. I mean, they're not nearly what was being fashioned during the course of the a special session. I mean, you had 12 agencies that are being held harmless, five that are getting, you know, some necessary increase. You've got 48 agencies that are being cut, but the largest cut's 4%, and that's higher ed. So, I mean, while there are cuts, most of the agencies, when you talk to these folks and you hear what they've been telling the lawmakers in these appropriations and budget hearings and meetings, is that we can sustain some of this. Is it what they want to do? Is it what they need to do long term? In their view, no. But the idea that that they've just taken a meat axe and somehow just had this wholesale disruption of state functioning agencies across the board is not true. So I think the dust needs to settle and everyone needs to figure out really where the starting point is on the first day of session in February.
And those cuts, I think, taken in context, we're looking at agencies right now that have already sustained cuts of 20-30% over the last decade. The money that we're using to mitigate the amount of cuts right now, oftentimes one-time monies. And then you've got State Treasurer Ken Miller, who recently came out and said, some of the money you're hoping to use in this, I'm not going to release from the unclaimed property fund. You're trying to take money out of our operating fund, and you think that it's a reserve, a revolving account in the Treasurer's Department. What other things are they missing in putting this together? And then there's the question with the Department of Health, where at some point are we going to, in the next two or three months before special session starts, see where millions of dollars in federal money may have been misappropriated, and we either owe that back or we lose some
federal grants. And I think that is incumbent upon the legislature to now really stop talking about looking at these agencies and getting down into the deep, recesses of these budget lines and figuring out really where they're at. I mean, micromanaging agencies is not the issue. Figuring out how the money is properly being spent and whether the efficiencies are really there. I mean, some of these cuts over time have not all been bad, but what we now have is a situation where we don't know what's good or what's bad, and we certainly don't know what's lingering out there with this issue with the Department of Health and whether we've got millions of dollars that may have to be repaid if we have issues with federal grants or other things that may come into play.
And you have them calling for audits of a lot of these agencies, and yet they're cutting money to the state auditor and inspector. So, which makes it even more difficult.
At some point,
there
has to be a clear direction and a resolve on the part of the legislature, if that is their intent, to see how to get to the bottom line and do it in a credible way that they can go back and tell the public, tell their folks that are wanting to decide whether or not to send them back next election year. Have they really done what they said they were going to do, or just talked about it? And that's really been the rub, I think, on a lot of this stuff where the agencies are concerned.
And are Oklahoma voters going to have the confidence in their legislature or in the legislature as a whole entity? I just don't see it. I mean, I think that we had this 8-week special session, and I'm saying 8 weeks like it's over. It may not be over, but 8-week special session, and now we're going to walk into an election cycle. I do not have a lot of hope right now that Oklahoma can dig itself out of this budget crisis that we're in. And, frankly, the indicia of our becoming a failed state, our inability to deliver basic fundamental services to the people of Oklahoma, that indicia just keeps going up and up and up.
The state Republican Party holds on to two seats and loses one in special elections. Republican Paul Rossino wins the seat vacated by Kyle Loveless, and Ross Ford beat out the opponent for the House seat held by the late David Brumbaugh. But Democrat Allison Eichley Freeman took the seat held by Tulsa Republican Senator Dan Newberry, who's retiring at the end of January. Neva, your thoughts on this news?
Well, I think, overall, good night for the Republicans, obviously, holding on to the two seats. The third that you mentioned was close, 31 votes unofficially was the count.
I had to look at that again. I was like, 31%? No, 31%.
And so I think that was razor thin. We had a situation where in each of these districts, low turnout, like we expected, hard ground game fought on both sides. In the race that the Democrats did take, I mean, they were coming off the heels of a success in the Tulsa area already this year, and kind of that same campaign team clearly was involved in that race and had a good hard fought campaign plan that played out well for them. So in the Rossino race, I think when you look at the South Oklahoma City and the Canadian County district that encompasses, what seemed to take place was even though the Democrats mounted a very aggressive, very solid campaign, the Republicans, it's a dominated Republican district, they came home with the bread and butter issues that they wanted to hear their candidate talk about and actually did a very good job of upping the turnout and making it possible for him to win with a very solid 58%. In the third race, the 70% win by the Republican, again, I think was no surprise given the district and given given what was expected going into that one. I think even the Democrats probably would say that would be the one that they had the least anticipation of being able to have an upset. Yeah.
Ryan.
You know, four Democratic flips in the last year in these special elections. I think that's huge. I think that what we're seeing is also a signal of where the Democratic's new political power is going to be coming from over the next generation. Suburban areas, metropolitan areas, that's where these wins are taking place. And that's not unique to Oklahoma. When we saw the big election returns coming out of Virginia last week, where Democrats won everything from the governor's office to the state house, a lot of those election victories were fueled by good turnout from suburban metropolitan areas. But it's really the suburbs that are growing in Democratic performance. We saw that Allison Eichley Freeman, congratulations to Senator-elect Eichley Freeman, a huge win, 26 years old, somebody who really came out of political obscurity. She wasn't on the scene. She said she stepped up. She saw a crisis in the state of Oklahoma. She wanted to run for office. And a lot of the political powers that be, I'm told, were out actually trying to recruit candidates that fit the model for what a good candidate in a race like this looks like. And, you know, it's good job, to Senator Eichley Freeman, pro-choice, openly gay. She ran against somebody who ran one of the, bread and butter Republican campaigns, very pro-life, very anti-choice, and that just didn't work. And I think that because of the good, solid campaign management of Sarah Baker, some volunteer folks, Lauren Van Allen and Robert Goins, Anastasia Langthorne, who was on Rachel Maddow earlier this week, Anastasia, the youngest Democratic Party chair in the nation right now. What we're seeing is, I think, a response to the failed leadership in the state legislature, but also a real investment in smarter campaigning.
Well, and all campaigns are local. I mean, we have three more specials coming up. It'll be interesting to see how those play out. I mean, you've got two in the House, one in the Senate. I think two Republicans, one Democrat leaving those seats. So, I mean, it, again, is the competition on the ground in low turnout races and the candidate and the message. And in the primaries, I mean, what's going to be interesting to see for Republicans is what message resonates. I mean, are the Republicans wanting to hear about strong fiscal conservative policy, or do they want to talk about something that is about dealing with the issues in terms of budget and the need for more revenue, if that's their point of view, and how that will collide, I mean, with the Republican voters? I think that's going to be a fascinating thing to watch.
While the race is also always local, it's about how many doors you knock and getting people to go out and vote. It's also how much is it the fact that the above-the-fold story almost in every paper is this issue that's going on with the special session.
I think that's a big part of it. And when there's this idea that has permeated among Democratic circles for far too long, that if you're going to be a viable Democrat in a general election, in particular in these suburban seats or in rural seats, that you've got to run as far to the right as you can. You've got to take social issues off the table. You've got to, you know, look as much like a Republican without being a Republican as possible. That's been a failed strategy for the Democrats for a decade, if not a generation now. And we're beginning to see that change. And what happens is that whenever you go out there and you're not trying to campaign as the most pro-life candidate in the race, and you're actually talking about education, you're talking about mental health care, you're talking about health care in general, you're talking about infrastructure, all of these things that voters right now are beginning to feel. And I think for a long time, the misery at the Capitol has been very vague. It hasn't really touched home to voters. But now I think that it's difficult to find a family in the state of Oklahoma that doesn't feel the real impact of the budget crisis.
I think it's going to be fascinating to watch in the Oklahoma Panhandle seat, the Senate seat that Bryce Marlatt resigned. Yeah. You have a primary where you have a state representative, Casey Murdoch, who's running, but you also have you have the Republican National Committee woman, Carol McLarty, that's running, and her first mail piece, basically, talk about a the shot across the bow is showing the board on the House vote for raising all of the taxes and circling her opponent and saying, is this what we want? I mean, and so I think it becomes this hard line divide of Republicans having to decide what do we want our elected officials to go up there and do? And I think it's a moving target, as we've seen in many of these races and even some of these primaries so far.
And if we see any Republican legislator either get beat in a primary or have a close primary because they voted for the budget plan that had the increased revenue package in it.
Yeah.
If that happens, I think what happens, the dynamic, the ability of Speaker McCaul or any speaker at that point in the Republican caucus to put 69, 70, 71 votes on the board, it gets a lot harder, right? I mean, their job gets harder. I think that it underscores the importance then of what I think is a growing statewide movement, a bipartisan movement, to revisit the restrictions that are placed on the budget process by State Question 640. So at some point, we're going to have that conversation as a state.
And hopefully, yeah. I would hope that it would also lend to the conversation of perhaps it is time to look at the whole concept of term limits and whether or not we want that to continue in our state legislature
there
as well.
Two 90s things that have basically changed all of Oklahoma politics. Now, speaking of elections, Democrats did announce yesterday that they are keeping their primaries open to independents. The party is choosing to keep in place a decision made in 2015 to allow non-Democrats to vote. Ryan, do you think this part has helped the Democratic Party?
I think it's huge. Absolutely. I think that it helps in the general election. If independents have an opportunity to feel like they have a voice in these primaries, I think they're more likely to be engaged in general elections. And if they've weighed in, they've got some skin in the game on these Democratic primaries, I think they're more likely to show up for Democrats. Independents are the largest growing voter bloc in the state of Oklahoma. More and more Oklahomans, regardless of what their historic political identity has been, I think are frustrated with the two-party system. They don't like the idea of having to pigeonhole themselves as a Democrat or a Republican. They want that kind of flexibility. I think it would behoove the Republican Party to open their primaries up as well, even though that may take away some political advantage to the Democrats. I do think that it, in general, increases participation in people that feel like they've got a voice in this Democratic process. Ultimately, of course, I've talked about this on the program before. I think we need to move away from this single-member majority process that we have right now that props up the two-party system, open it up to proportional representation, and let's get more than two parties out there actually competing. But until that time, we've got to open up avenues for independent voters to
participate. Ryan,
to
what's the parliamentary system?
I may not live that long, but...
And we're getting this word about the Democrats, just as the Libertarians just a few months ago said they're closing their primary.
Big mistake.
Which was amazing. I mean, you mentioned the time, Alan.
That's right. And apparently was fairly evenly divided among their group, as small as it is, on that particular issue. But I would agree with Ryan. I mean, it's going to be interesting long term, particularly in the metropolitan, the suburb, these suburban areas and the areas where you have younger voters who have traditionally the evidence is that they are more likely to register independent than with one of the two major parties. Whether or not that influences their ability to be more interested and ultimately participate better at the ballot box, because to this point that hasn't happened. And I think the verdict's out on whether this will be a vehicle that the Democrats successfully use to try to capture some of those votes and have them be more impacting on a general election.
A petition to call for a vote on a teacher pay raise in Oklahoma City gets turned in with more than enough signatures to start the process. It calls for a temporary 0.5% income tax rate increase to raise $50 million a year for the raises. Ryan, is this something you can get behind?
Oh, absolutely. Well, I think that it's something that becomes a necessity. This is as much a referendum on where we need to be funding education in Oklahoma County and Oklahoma City. But it's also a referendum on the legislature and the idea that we would hope that the state would be funding education at the adequate level, but the legislature hasn't been able to get their act together. We're facing the structural budget deficit. We're going to be $650 million in the hole come the next legislative session in an election year. And so I think what you're going to see, not just in Oklahoma City, but you'll probably begin to see this in other areas as well, where they're going to have to take some local action to bring some revenue into the system so that they can begin to make investments that they need at the local level. You know, 16,000 signatures when they need, you know, close to 12,000, it's likely to survive as they go through and review all of the signatures. And I think that we'll see this on the ballot. I would be surprised if it doesn't pass.
Neither.
And it's interesting with this 0.5% income tax that they're talking about. I mean, the $50 million that would be raised, it would be over 4 years and then be sunsetted. So it's a concept that sets up for a very interesting campaign. I mean, from what I understand, I mean, there's an anti-campaign, you know, that already is beginning to prepare, certainly to battle this. But I think even beyond the issue of is this a funding mechanism that the voters will buy into for education at the Oklahoma City public school level, is the fact that in the 125-year history of Oklahoma City, only this is the 37th time that this initiative petition process has been used. If it should be successful, would that open the door to kind of the floodgate opens and there are many more petitions that are put forward to really circumvent the what in the estimation of many of these folks is the incapacity of the legislature to deal with these issues efficiently and bring it back to the local level. So long term, when you think about where this could head, I mean, it has some enormous implications, and I think it sets up for that reason to be kind of a battle royale when we see this on the ballot, which I agree with Ryan. I think it will meet the threshold on the signatures. They were ahead of schedule even in the petition gathering, and so it'll be fascinating to see where we go from here.
Or maybe even change some city decisions. I mean, if you got a group of people who are against the panhandling ordinance, for example, you could come in and say, no, we need to change that, and then more the people's voice rather than representation on the city council.
So it's interesting. You said, you know, only 37. That there had been 37. I was like, oh my gosh, there had been 37. That kind of blew me away that it had been used that much.
I was thinking that out of 105 years, that
125 years.
25 years, and you'd think there would have been done more, a lot more.
Yeah. So I was
have that in every 4 years.
Well, it's difficult. I mean, let's face it. I mean, the petition gathering process, they don't make it. I mean, it's not an easy process when, you know, it's just a few under 12,000 votes that you have to have certified to be able to move forward. So you have to have an issue that's got a broad range of appeal among the voters to even get it to the place where it is right now.
But on the municipal level, it's so much easier to do that at a municipal level, that's, you know, even in the smaller cities, but even in Oklahoma City, the largest city in the state, to get that 11,900 vote threshold that you had to get this year. That's a heck of a lot easier than the threshold at a statewide initiative.
Sure.
And, you know, just as we saw paralysis at the federal level lead to, I think, a renewed commitment at the state level to, we're going to take care of some stuff if the feds can't do it. And now we're seeing paralysis at the state level. You know, frankly, if anybody's looking at running for office, you know, kudos to all the folks jumping in these legislative seats. But, you know, if you're running at the local level, whether it's county or municipal level, your ability to have an impact, I think, is much larger. We haven't seen that same level of paralysis there. And whether it's through the initiative process or whether it's through city councils or county commissioners, I think we're going to see more and more local governments try to take control, try to, you know, keep hospitals from closing, to keep schools from closing. That's what it's going to take, because I just don't have a lot of faith that the legislature is going to get us there.
Big election in the Oklahoma County with Ray Vaughn choosing not to run. So that's going to be a very big race.
You know, and
it's
kind of a sleeper issue on the county commissioners when you look at the numbers, because the governor has appointed 20 county commissioners in the last 2 years, either from death, bribery charges, whatever it happens to be. I mean, something that has taken them out of office. So, I mean, there's a lot going on at the county level, and there's certainly been a lot of discussion on and off through the years about modernizing county government, something that when you speak those words, mm-hmm. I mean, the courthouses, rise up and show their political muscle, which is still very significant in the state of Oklahoma, as any legislator or any, you know, person that's run statewide will tell you very quickly. So, But there are a lot of issues like that. 77 counties in a state this size. I mean, the duplication with three county commissioners in every single, you know, county of the 77. I mean, there are a lot of things that could be looked at that no one's even kind of scratched the surface on that could have tremendous impact in terms of what's being what's the cost is to the taxpayer.
Death and bribery. I mean, the two things that are certain in life are death and taxes. And I guess in
and
county
we've
government.
Added one more, I guess.
In county government, it's death and bribery.
And
you know, I think that as we look at these county positions, they're going to and municipal positions, they're going to become all the more important, whether that's district attorney, county commissioners. But we also have a legislature right now, and this is interesting. We've got a legislature right now that can't get their job done. But in the last several years, they've passed more and more pieces of legislation that restrict what local and county governments are able to do on their own. So, you know, if there's paralysis at the local and the county level right now, it's imposed by the state legislature that can't get their own work done.
There you go. Ryan and Eva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.